We humans think we are awfully clever, but the rest of the animal kingdom has sometimes got things figured out before we do. Take, for example, the problem of predators. Some ducks have black heads so you can't see their eyes. That's because predators won't strike when they think their prey is watching, so hidden eyes will throw them off. The patterns on butterfly wings sometimes have fake eyes, lots of fake eyes, so a predator will think it's always being watched. Humans borrowed this trick at a tiger reserve in India. The reserve was in a forest that was also being used for timber, and workers kept getting eaten by tigers.
It was a very serious problem because a lot of people were getting eaten until they put to use this idea that a predator doesn't like to be watched and won't attack if it's being watched. They gave the foresters Halloween masks. And they wear them on the back of their head so that they seem to have eyes in front and eyes in back. And the tigers thought they were always being watched. And nobody got eaten after that.
This idea that we can solve serious human problems by imitating nature is called biomimicry. And one of the presenters at the upcoming Maker Fair in Union Station will be using that concept to inspire the next generation of makers. Becky Plumberg, welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Thank you.
How did you get into biomimicry?
Well, I work at the Nature Center in Science City, and we wanted to be more than just a petting zoo. We wanted to have the science behind the animals. And so I started doing some research and came across biomimicry. Basically, by mistake, I was researching animals and kept seeing this word pop up, and I thought, I'm going to really investigate this. And it is an amazing science, basically, where we just look to nature to help us solve some of our problems because nature has solved them all.
What excited you about this? Enough that you turned it into a whole, like, area of programming?
The idea that we actually had some of these animals in our nature center that have inspired people to create these wonderful inventions, innovations, architecture, materials. One of those is our geckos. Geckos have the amazing ability to climb up glass, any surface, even upside down.
Climbing up glass does, like, when you think about it, that's crazy.
It is crazy, and it's like Spider-Man, too, but it's a little different than Spider-Man does it. The geckos have tiny microscopic hairs on the bottoms of their feet, which they are doing a, basically, we call it a molecular hug. And
That sounds so sweet.
It does, doesn't it? And they are sinking their little feet, the tiny hairs, into the molecules of the surface that they're climbing. And it's a very strong bond, but they also have the ability to pull away. So NASA has taken this science a step further and have created gecko grippers, which they hope to be using in the International Space Station to help, for one thing, wrangle space junk out of the air, which can be going at a terrific speed and rotating. And this material that they've come up with can just grip onto it and pull it out.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And then are there other animals in the Nature Center?
There are. If we look at our, we have hissing cockroaches from Madagascar. They are looking at the way these roaches can crawl in and out of small, tiny spaces, the way they maneuver.
You know, I just want to say about that, that is not usually a cockroach trait that is celebrated by humans.
These are the good cockroaches. These are the ones that we do want around. They live on the forest floor in Madagascar. They eat the rotting fruit and vegetables at night, and then they hide during the day. But they can maneuver quite well in dark. And in small spaces. And so for rescue during an emergency, they can hopefully make a robot that is modeled after the cockroach in order to do search and rescue.
So there are people working on that right
now? There are people working on that right now.
What do you know about that?
Like, also using a snake, too.
It seems like the cockroach, I mean, okay, so I jokingly said that their ability to maneuver in and out of small spaces is not something we usually celebrate. But it's also true that we refer to cockroaches often jokingly as like they're going to survive the apocalypse.
Exactly. Like,
and so is that kind of the observation that led people to say, well, wait, these are creatures that can survive
Exactly.
Almost anything.
But it's their maneuverability that they are really looking at, the way that they can move in the dark. They have their heads down constantly, and they're moving in and out of very tight spaces. And when a natural disaster or, you know, a building collapses and you're searching for people that have survived, you need to be able to move in and out. They even are talking about putting, and it has been done, putting little cameras on them in order for that search and rescue. So
it seems like the nature of that problem is kind of, if a person is stuck inside rubble, then a person outside of it would also be stuck on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about the moment when someone had that aha, like cockroaches could do this?
I don't know exactly when that happened, but I know robotics has been playing a big part of it, but just because people can't maneuver underneath there, they need to come up with a different way. And this sounds like a pretty darn good solution if they can work with it.
I want to get into some more examples of this shortly, but what do you think it is about this phenomenon that has sort of potential to fuel kids' imaginations?
That's just it. You hit it on the head right there. It fuels their imagination. When kids come into the nature center, I will get out our little gecko and I will let them feel him actually bonding or hugging their hands when he crawls on them.
What does it feel like?
It kind of feels like you're one side of Velcro. So when he crawls on you, it tickles. But then when you start to pull him away, he clings. And the cool thing is they notice that there's nothing left behind once he's off. There's no damage. There's no residue because it's not an adhesive. And so it gets their little brains thinking. And I'll start asking about other animals. Well, this chameleon, he can move his eyes 360 degrees and individually. And so he can see all around him. How could we use that? What could you do with that? And they will come up with some wonderful ideas.
Like what?
Surveillance. Surveillance cameras. How can you make those cameras move individually? Maybe two camera lenses going. They come up with these wonderful ideas that sometimes adults don't even think of.
You know, okay, so I am a grown-up, but I've been really nerding out on this since finding out about it through you, of course.
And you will. You'll just keep researching and researching it.
Well, I love that the problems we think are so particular to humans actually aren't, and that over billions of years of evolution, the natural world has kind of... You know, it's like people who have lived for a long time will say to younger people, like, you know, listen to me, I have experience with this. But it's almost like all of humanity is like that younger person looking to nature.
Exactly. Nature has solved every problem. And if they need to come up with an adaptation for a problem, they'll come up with it. Nature survives. If we look to nature to help us solve our problems, you're right. We are the child now. And all of a sudden, nature is showing us how to do something. The trick is mimicking it without causing more waste, without coming up with something else that's going to replace what it is we're trying to replace.
So like creating a new problem while we're solving one.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can we, As someone who has been recently paying a lot more attention to this phenomenon, do you see the natural world differently yourself, like as you're out on walks or whatever?
You do. You do. You see how water drains off of a leaf. You see how bugs, there are some bugs that can walk on water. There are different things that you observe, and you think, maybe we could make that work for somebody who needs clean water. It's endless. It's absolutely endless with your imagination.
Can we get into more examples of how this concept of biomimicry has actually led to both really what we would now think of as commonplace things, but also very novel ideas? Velcro. You mentioned Velcro, but Velcro was invented... biomimicry.
It was through biomimicry. If I make the sound here, well, everybody knows this sound, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You have to have two sides to it. But it came about by a gentleman who was out walking. He ends up with cockleburrs all over his socks. And he's wondering, how do they stick like that? And so he starts studying them and came up with this loop and hook idea. and created Velcro, which we've had around since the 1950s. Even Leonardo da Vinci was using biomimicry. They just didn't call it that when he was studying bird wings to create his flying machines. He would actually dissect bird wings to try to figure out how they worked, and bat wings as well.
There are some other examples that I know you include in your presentation. Some of, now I would say we're getting into the territory of things people are working on right now or have very recently come up with. There's a kind of window glass that mimics spider webs.
Exactly. Scientists were noticing that in the big rainforests, there are big spiders, and some of them make big orb webs. Why are birds not flying into these webs? They fly around. They would actually observe the birds flying around them. Come to find out, the spiders are including a UV thread throughout that web. Birds can see UV light. We cannot. So they were able to fly around. So the company Ornolux came up with a glass, because this is a problem of birds flying into high-rise buildings and even into our homes. We've had that happen where they think the glass is a continuation of the trees because it reflects what's out there, and so they fly right into it. We lose literally billions of birds a year just in the United States by flying into glass. So what Ornolux did is they incorporated a UV thread through the glass, and the birds can see it. You can't if you're looking at the glass.
So you're holding up a piece of this glass, like a little square, and I see nothing.
You can't see it. So it doesn't hinder the view for the people inside the building, but the birds can know to fly around that building so they don't fly right directly into the glass.
Is that pretty commonly used now or not?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I know in Canada they are starting to use it because they have a huge problem with the birds flying into their big city buildings up there. Whether it's taking hold in the United States yet, I don't know. When I contacted this company to get a sample, they sent me a sample right away. So I have a bigger sample that I use at work with the kids too, and they think it's the coolest thing ever.
And there's some architectural innovation going on inspired by termite mounds.
There is. The Eastgate building in Zimbabwe. It was built in the late 90s. But they noticed that the termites in Africa build these huge mounds. It's very hot where they build it. But they managed to build it in a way that it cools itself through ventilation. So they modeled a number of buildings, including this famous Eastgate building, using that as the inspiration to make those changes in their structure to help with ventilation so that they're not constantly running air conditioning. So
how do you think a presentation on biomimicry fits into a maker fair? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. The maker fair is fun in that it's kind of like science and technology meets arts and crafts. So when you're talking about looking to nature to help us solve our problems, well, material scientists look to nature to help solve our problems. For instance, this bag of lotion was inspired by a lotus leaf seed because it doesn't take up a lot of space. Once you start getting the product out of it, you get every last drop. When they ship this, they can flatten it before they fill it. They can flatten it. They can get thousands and thousands of these bags on a roll that takes up the same space as like 200 rigid bottles on a truck. So that's design. That's part of making. Somebody had to make that. So it's a perfect fit for in.
Well, Becky Plumberg with us from Science City, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Becky's presentation on biomimicry will be part of the Maker Faire at Union Station, not this weekend, but the one after that. The whole maker trend encompasses a range of things from science and technology to old-timey crafts and artisanship. Up next, a folk artist who works with wood and lasers. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're sticking with next week's Maker Faire for a little while longer, but this time with something different. Our next guest is not an inventor or tech person per se. She is a local artist, and she's tapping into the folk traditions of the country where she was born. In fact, her business is called Folkville. Veronica Carinder, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You make things out of wood, lots of home decor type pieces with like light switch covers or pieces that look like those old-fashioned needlepoint signs that people hung in their homes that say things like, bless this house or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the designs and phrases are cut into wood, giving them this very clean, precise look.
Yes, that's true. I take inspiration from my home country of Slovakia, and that folk art of Slovakia is really rich and colorful, beautiful. It is inspired by nature, so that's where I get my inspiration as well. And I'm trying to combine it with like modern techniques of making things, so things like laser cutting and paper cutting that weren't available in the olden days. So taking something historic, bringing it into modern life and combining with technology, and something new becomes alive. So that's what I like about the process and the result of it.
What are your memories of those designs, the folk art that inspires you now, but from your own childhood?
That's funny, because when I was a kid, I didn't really pay attention to it. And when I was a teenager, I didn't really like it. Like, the folk music and everything just seemed a little old-fashioned to me. But after I moved to U.S. and I started to miss my family and everything, you kind of become aware of where you come from and kind of dig deeper into the history of your own country. And that's how I fell in love with the folk art.
What did you start to see in it as you went through that process of digging deeper that you hadn't appreciated as a kid?
I think the inspiration by nature, and also the symmetry and kind of geometry in it as well. I study architecture, so I always liked symmetrical compositions and patterns and things like that. So, and the colors, of course, they're just bright and beautiful.
Can you take me through the sort of epiphany that you could do something inspired by this folk art, but do it in a totally modern way?
It's kind of hard to walk a person through that process. I think it's really personal. I often get inspired just when I'm outside, out of nowhere. And then I start thinking about, okay, how can I incorporate it in a product that you can have at home and also use, because I like beautiful, useful things. And I imagine a product, and first I try to find it somewhere, if it already exists. And I usually don't find things that I want, so I decide to make it. And then after I make it, people give you feedback, and you kind of develop the product further, or change it, or make it more up to date, I would say. So yeah, it's hard, but it's kind of unique and creative. And every day you can think of something else, and you know, you never know what you're gonna come up with.
Was it your interest in architecture that brought you here?
Yes, that's correct. I was an exchange student at K-State for a year. I came 2012. It was an exchange program. It was so far the best year of college, I would say. I spent a year here, and then I had to go back to Slovakia to graduate. And while I was here, I met my husband. So after graduation, I decided to move here. But yeah, architecture brought me here, actually. And I worked as an architect for 3 years while I was here. But now it wasn't as creative as I thought it would be. So I always tried to find a creative outlet somewhere else. And now it's my everyday life, which I'm so happy about.
Making the pieces that are part of your Folkville line.
Yes, making art and making products and just working with my hands.
How does architecture, I mean, as something that you studied really intensively at a pretty high level, how does that find its way into these pieces that I would say are very small compared to buildings?
Yes. I think the main point there I would make is that architecture really pays attention to details. So everything, however big it is, you have to start small and you have to pay attention to the details. So I for sure use that knowledge in my art, and also not only that, but also the softwares that I learned during my studies. Draw my designs first by hand, which I did a lot before. It's pretty natural and easy for me. And then I transfer it to the iPad and use the Illustrator and InDesign and all those programs I used for architecture. I can incorporate into my art as well, and that's the part of the technology I combine with my art.
Does it also inform how you work with materials like wood? Does your background in architecture kind of help you do that, work with materials like wood?
Yeah, sure. We actually had a class about materials, so you learn all about their characteristics and their beauty and where you can use them, their structural properties and things like that. And one of the reasons I use bamboo is because it's so much harder than wood, and you can use this for coasters. It's water resistant. You can also use it for outside signs. Like, I have a lot of these signs about gardening. I love to garden. I love nature. I love animals. So those kind of quotes I try to incorporate into my designs, which is not usual for the Slovak folk art. But again, it's part of my own spirit I bring into that product.
I'm also guessing that laser cutters are not from traditional.
No, it's a pretty unnatural, I would say. But that's the beauty of it. Combine something historic with something new. And I used the laser cutter in during my studies. We used to make models of buildings. So that's another thing I know how to use, and I can use it to my advantage.
What does being a quote-unquote maker mean to you?
Maker is someone who manufactures or makes their own products by their hands. Sometimes it's really stressful and time-consuming, and you can get burned out pretty easily, but there's something about the manual work. It's kind of calming and almost like meditating. So I wouldn't say it's really work, even though it's hard sometimes, but it's not stressful. It's not as hard as your regular office job, I would say. So maker, yeah, someone who's creative, someone who creates the design and then take it through to the end, to the finished product.
You're part of an artist and maker collective here in town, right?
Yes, that's correct. I'm a part of Cherry Pit Collective. We are on Cherry Street, and it's a communal studio of women artists. And actually, on the Maker Fair, we will have a booth as a Cherry Pit Collective. I think six of us will have their own little small booths within the big one, and we will be displaying how we come up with the design or stages of our process. I will be actually sketching my designs on iPad.
When you talk about being part of a collective, and especially a collective of specifically women artists, what is that like? What does that give you?
It's great, because I have to say, when I came to Kansas City, I moved here, I didn't know anyone, and I went to a craft fair, I think 2 years ago, and I fell in love with that. I love to go to craft fairs. I love creative people and handmade things. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I wish I could do this sometime. And 2 years went by, and I was sitting at the strawberry swing, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I did it. Now I'm doing it. But that's basically because of the group of artists I met with, and they knew where to go and what to do. And it was so much easier for me to enter that community of makers in Kansas City.
Can you just talk a little bit? We've touched on this before today, but the range of people considered makers. Talk to me about that range.
It could be, I think it's wide range, but for me, maker is someone who is also creative, or at least in my environment, all the makers are also creatives. So we have jewelry makers, we have a person that makes handmade paper, and writers.
Writers?
Make things too, and it's creative. It's not something you can use, but it's something that inspires people.
Veronica Carinder, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Veronica sells her stuff through her business, Folkville, and she's a presenter along with lots of other local makers at next week's Maker Fair in Union Station. Next, we'll talk with people who make fireworks, and we want to know what you think about all the fireworks exploding on random streets all over town every 4th of July. Love it or hate it, 816-235-2888. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and a lot of people like to shoot off fireworks, but I'm here with two dudes who make fireworks, and they make them all year round, not just on the 4th of July. We'll hear their stories and learn about the art and science behind what they do, but we'll also be taking your calls on all the rogue fireworks in Kansas City at 816-235-2888. Sean Hammondtree is an artist, designer, composer, musician, lots of things, who got into the art of fireworks a few years back. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
And Kelly Easley is with us from the Kansas City Area Pyrotechnicians. Hello to you.
Good morning.
So I want to start by asking each of you what it is you love about fireworks. Kelly?
I love the rush of it. It's, you ask like why people jump out of planes. It's it's an adrenaline rush. It's the anticipation, seeing that fuse, you know, disappear, and then a woof, and the smell of the smoke, and then that burst in the sky that just, you know, the artistry that lights up the skies. And when you look around, the people behind you and their jaws are wide open, and you can see the lights in their eyes. It's really satisfactory to me to see the emotion that's displayed through fire.
Sean?
I agree with all of his points. And also, for me, it's an art form that takes so much effort and so much constant learning, and it gives you a 20-second reward, you know. And it, for me, it's
that doesn't sound necessarily like a selling point.
True. But I mean, for me, it's so similar to composing. It's so similar to I always compare it to culinary, which is one of my other big hobbies. And so, it's just a different form of that. And it's really,
like, it's something fleeting. The enjoyment of it is fleeting.
Absolutely. And it's also the alchemy of it. I mean, the beautiful, you know, when you get into the pure forms of it, creating the colors, creating all the aspects of it, to have this one moment is sort of a, dare I say, romantic almost, in essence.
Well, so the alchemy, as you're describing it, making a color, this brings me to my next question, which is how exactly a person makes fireworks?
A lot of ways. And, I was out of it for a few years just cause I really couldn't afford it, and slowly started getting back into it. And, when you start getting into like the finer points of it, you learn, you know, what chemical compounds create certain colors and how you apply them to create stars or comets. And it's kind of fun. For me, it's very, very fun because like you use bird seed and you learn to coat bird seed and learn to make stars a certain size because it burns for that long.
Sorry, but what do you use bird seed for?
You put them in a container that spins and you spray them with alcohol or some solution and you start dumping powder, the color combinations or whatever chemistry on it, and they roll and they start building up in size. And that's kind of the genesis of it.
Kelly, what can you tell us about just the process of making fireworks?
Well, making fireworks is one of those things where when people say that you're making fireworks, they look at you a little funny.
Because it could sound, I would think like this seems like a logistical hurdle and one that probably should be a logistical hurdle. Getting the materials to make something that explodes should probably be really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's not easy, but it's a hobby. It's an art form and a hobby. So if you think about a painter, how do they get paint? They can go to the art store. They can order it off the internet. They can make their own. And that's kind of way I look at fireworks.
So you look at it as an art form. Can you tell me more about what goes into it artistically?
Well, at the basic form is you're taking elements of chemical compositions, which is basically a metal of some sort, say like copper will give you a green color, and an oxidizer to make it burn. And combining those two elements will give you the desired effect that you're looking for.
You just reminded me of chemistry class in high school where the Bunsen burner to an element, the color of the flame that comes off of it tells mm-hmm. you what it is.
That's exactly what it is.
Right. Yeah.
What are your favorite kinds of fireworks?
My favorite are the, obviously the aerial shells, where you drop a shell into a mortar, a tube, and you light that, and like I said, there's an anticipation, and you hear a big, thud as that leaves that cannon, and it's hurled in the air, and then there's an anticipation for that to break. That, 1 to 2 seconds is just awe-inspiring once it lights up the whole sky and breaks, and have those colors and the combination of colors, and that's really where the artistry comes into it, is somebody took the time to lay those stars, those things that are igniting in that shell out in a particular pattern to create that effect. And it's time consuming. And that's why a lot of our stuff, that we import is, hours upon hours go into those shells on the larger scales. I'm not really a manufacturer like Sean is, but he will tell you that, a good shell will probably take you 2 or 3 days to put it all together. And then you go, well, I've spent 2 or 3 days on this and it may last 6 or 8 seconds in the air. And that's one of those things where it's all worth it, though, at the end.
Yeah, talk to me about that, Sean.
I love, my favorite are called girandolas. And they're very odd. And you make a wheel, basically, that you mount horizontally. And then you put drivers that propel it to spin, and then there's those talk to other drivers that then send it up into the sky, and it kind of looks like a good one will look like a giant jellyfish going 1,000 feet in the air, and they're,
it's almost like is it one of the ones that looks kind of like a fountain or something?
It can, it just depends on how it's constructed, and those things are they're so beautiful when they're made right, and it takes, it's a nice dance with each of the parts of this one firework.
So you would have to think in making something like that about the timing, how long it takes from the moment of coming in contact with a spark mm-hmm. until it's going to explode.
That's every firework. I mean, the timing is so incredibly important, and people don't really realize that when they're watching them. I mean, they don't have a reason to, but those things are created so that they know it's going to burst at 1,200 feet, and so these stars will burn out before they hit the ground. Those things are all focused on, and like my friend Jed, who taught me how to do this, he is light years better than I will ever be, and he is very, very good at it. And learning about all the minutiae that goes into creating a successful shell. It isn't just the report, as they call it, you know, when it bursts and everything and gives you the colors or the effects, but how it dissipates is just as important.
As someone who has written music too, that seems so similar to what you're describing. The
Absolutely.
Way, like when I think about like how you would think about the timing of every different instrument that would come in or something like that.
You're absolutely correct. And I think that was for me what, I mean, when I first went to a fireworks convention, it was out in Arizona. I was the little kid that heard the kabooms, you know, even though I was a grown adult, but I was sitting there giggling like a Beavis and Butthead cartoon. And there is that part, and that part will always exist. But then there's the cadence and the choreography and the colors, and it just was this weird, almost ritual version of, like, you know, merging all these art forms together.
When you talk about a fireworks convention or pyrotechnics convention, I guess, I mean, is that how someone who does this beyond special times of year or whatever, is that how you get to, like, actually go and shoot off the fireworks you've been working on?
Yeah, it's an environment where, you know, it's licensed, it's, you know, appropriated, you know, correctly, and you get to meet this diverse group of people that are everything from retired aerospace engineers to just guys that like booms, and they all converge together, and you get to manufacture on site and set it off in the evening. And for some people, it's how they test to see what they're going to do for the next year, you know, did I do it well? For some people, it's just their yearly outburst of
And you've actually traveled to other parts of the world to learn more about how other cultures make fireworks, use them.
Yeah, Malta, and that's the real deal. And you have to, like, earn respect. These are, like, you know, decades, maybe century old recipes, and they don't just give it away. So you have to go and work with them and do, you know, labor for them, and then they might tell you a little bit about, okay, well, I'll show you how to do this one thing. And it's an interesting culture.
Kelly, how did you get into fireworks?
Ever since I was a kid, we had the fireworks stand in town, and, you know, we would beg our moms to stop, you know, you got to stop. And she, you know, and she would usually give in to us about, like, the 1st of July. And then by the time the 4th rolled around, we'd already shot everything off. So we'd have to beg her to go back for the 4th of July. But, I mean, it's one of those things that's deep in tradition, in at least in my family and in my community. And, you know, I really didn't get into the hobby of it until probably 4 or 5 years ago, when we, you know, started looking into some of the compositions and really what makes fireworks so magical, and got hooked up with the Kansas City area pyrotechnicians. And we are not a manufacturing club, but we are an artistry club, and our big draw is pyro musicals, where we script and choreographed, you know, fireworks going off to music. And we do that all over the state, and we travel, and we have competitions with St. Louis. We just finished one up in Columbia.
World Series of fireworks.
Pretty much. We call it the Governor's Cup, you know, where we compete against them. We didn't win this year, but it was close. But that is really, if you're an enthusiast and you love fireworks, you know, more than just 4th of July, and you want to shoot stuff off around the year, getting into a local club is the best way to really get your feet wet, because fireworks is really passing knowledge from person to person to person, and it's generation to generation to generation. And it's one of those things where it brings a community together. And if you look all around the world, you know, villages and celebrations have always been around fireworks, and it gets people out of the house. And it's one of those things you can't watch on TV and experience the same effect as looking straight up in the air.
You say it gets people out of the house. I should say it also keeps some people inside the house.
It does.
Can you talk to me about that? I mean, you both love fireworks, but there are people who really dread the 4th of July because it feels like a bit much. At least the way it goes down in Kansas City, it can be.
Well, I'll say this. Kansas City has a ban on fireworks. And I would say that prohibition probably never works, right? So I can stand here on the 4th of July and look in any direction and see fireworks going off within the city. So the bans, you know, therefore, I don't know the reason of the ban, but I would like to see, you know, I'm all against, you know, having a cul-de-sac full of fireworks and debris and everything else. Is there a public place where you can go light fireworks? I don't know of one.
And so you're suggesting that there might be a way to let people set off fireworks, but have designated places so
they're
you're not
do
like...
it anyway. Mm-hmm. People are going to light fireworks.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's the only thing that makes it so problematic is I definitely understand the desire to set off fireworks. And sometimes that desire for some people outweigh just taking a moment to think about certain consequences, you know, like all the ground stuff is great and everything, but it's people that...
What do you mean by all the ground stuff?
Things that aren't going to go aerial and have a, you know, where regardless of what people may think, there's only so much physics you have control over. So things like bottle rockets, I mean, all it has to do is land on a roof. Because what a lot of people don't understand is like what I was speaking to earlier about how these things are meant to dissipate before they hit the ground. Well, the roof of a house is higher than the ground. And so certain things like that, I think, are what caused the bigger problem. And it just needs to be looked at a little more meticulously. Because everyone should be able to light off fireworks. It is. It's great. It's fun. It brings people together and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just a matter of figuring out the problematic areas instead of just, you know, hitting it with one broad brush.
But talk to me about safety, because I think like the stereotype of someone who joins a pyrotechnics club is maybe of someone who is not like the most cautious individual, but it sounds to me like safety is top of mind for you.
I would debate that. I mean, it is like the safety courses you have to take are intense and they're grueling and they're hard and rightfully so. And I mean, that's the most I've learned out of fireworks, more than even how to make them, is how to not be an idiot with them. Because there are, for every one thing that you can imagine going wrong, there's probably 10 other things.
How do people talk about safety in the pyrotechnics community?
We follow the National Fire Protection Code to the letter. So there's a, you know, the NFPA book basically has an outline for fireworks. And that's one thing that your 4th of July, you know, your backyarders don't have to go through that course. But it's, you know, the biggest thing is distance from your audience and, you know, fallout area, as we talked about, is where is that debris going to land? Fire, you know. Do you have adequate fire control?
I mean, it seems to me that on some level you are actually making an argument in favor of letting people who have training be the ones who do this.
Sure.
But I am also hearing you, Sean, say that everyone should be able to do this.
Smartly. I mean, and some of that just depends on the kind of firework it is. You know, if you're like around a bunch of houses, probably not really wise to send the really high-flying stuff out in your neighborhood. Stick to the ground fountains and those fun things, because they're just, you know, they're very pretty. And I mean, granted, you know, like some people just don't have the introduction to the potential dangers. You know, it isn't like I have met the guy who came up to, you know, and said, you know, you be careful with that, and he's missing like several digits. You know, like,
so you listened to that guy.
Oh yeah, that guy, yeah, his wisdom was visual.
Let's talk to Jake in South Kansas City. Hi, Jake.
Yes, just curious what the licensing situation is for you guys, you know, whether it's the feds and how many levels, and whether you guys have ever come across George Plimpton's piece he did years ago, and I think the first Vanity Fair when they republished. It's kind of, it's an amazing piece that George Plimpton did on the history of fireworks and the state of them at the time. But
well, you know,
the licensing thing.
Jake, before we get into the answer to the licensing question, I'd love for you to talk about what it was in that piece that stuck with you and that.
Well, it's been, I don't know when they began to republish. It's been 30 years or better, and it was a 5 or 6 page, you know, article that Plimpton did, and it was astounding. It went into some of the characters that were currently involved in the manufacture of fireworks, but it gave a history, a real rich history, you know, especially back to the Chinese, mm-hmm. and then the art of it. It was just, you know, and George Plimpton was just the consummate writer. So,
right. Well, Jake, thank you.
It was a great read.
Thank you for that recommendation. And we'll also get an answer to that question. But while we're on this topic, what is it, you know, when does the history of fireworks inspire you guys? No.
I mean, I appreciate it, and I have read it. I have not read what he's talking about, and I will seek that out. That sounds interesting. I didn't realize that that existed, but I do like the history of it, but it didn't really play into any kind of inspiration or anything.
Well, so what about this question of who licenses people to make or set off fireworks?
It's a process, and it's an expensive one. That was why, like, for a few years, I had to kind of bow out, especially in a post 9/11 world. Everything kind of changed a lot with how you acquire a license. You have license for manufacturing, you have licenses for doing shows and what have you. There's various kinds, and also to the degree of what kind of explosives you're trying to do. Like, they're labeled like 1.4, 1.3, which are just different calibers of boom, if you will.
Well, I have a federal explosives license, which is a Type 54. Mm-hmm. permit, which allows me to possess and transport fireworks. I also have a Missouri Pyrotechnics Operator's Permit, which allows me to light fireworks. Yeah. I also have to have a permit from the authority having jurisdiction, which is usually the local fire marshal of where I'm putting the display on, that they come out, they inspect the site, they make sure I'm, you know, up shape with the code before we. So there's three levels of permitting that you need. So just because you have, you know, a state permit does not mean you can, right. you know, purchase the material. Just because you have the federal permit doesn't mean you can light the material. So there's a lot of that goes into it. I would say the federal permit's probably the easiest to get. The state permit, you know, actually you have to take the fire code test. And you have to, and all these are renewed every 3 years, so you have to be up on your game.
We have a listener who's contacted us, a listener by the name of Joy, who says, I'm a retired environmental scientist and have grave concerns about the toxic effects of the chemicals put into the air by the heavy use of fireworks locally. I live in South Hyde Park, and the amount of fireworks fired off in Gillam Park causes a haze of pollutants over my whole neighborhood. I actually leave for the 4th of July to avoid breathing the dangerous haze. And that is really striking that an environmental scientist looks at that haze and says, I'm out of here.
It's a fair point. I mean, I have no argument to it. I mean, that is a consequence.
Well, where there's fire, there's usually smoke. That's kind of, and you can't have fireworks without fire, mm-hmm. is my argument. And they always say that the grass is always greener under the fallout area, because a lot of the oxidizers are like potassium nitrate, which is basically fertilizer.
Yeah.
So the air, there are pollutants in the air. I don't believe it's at a level where it, you know, causes harm. Everything from a consumer standpoint that comes through here is, you know, inspected and approved by the Consumer Product Safety Board. So those studies have been done.
Yeah. And also, if you see smoke, I mean, at least it's indicating that everything burnt off. It's one thing to have just a hazy remnants of what was there. It's another thing when the actual chemistry itself doesn't go off and it comes back in the ground. Then that's a worse issue.
We have a listener named Brett who's tweeting us, leaving us on the idea of being neighborly. I live in the country. Fireworks and animals are always a risk. Neighbors should be neighborly and ask about it. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? How can you be neighborly when you're setting off fireworks?
I just to do just that. I mean, like, most fireworks shoots and things that I've been to or been part of, that was always one of the first things you did. You went and you spoke to everyone around you. You even called the fire department, you know. and be, you know, upfront about it.
Yeah, I'm a dog lover. I've got two lovely Italian greyhounds. They do not like fireworks. I've not yet to meet a dog that does like fireworks. Yeah. So, yeah, if you're next door to somebody that you know has animals, have that discussion with them. I think you can work something out. So,
well, our time is up, but keep us posted on what's going on in your neighborhood on Twitter as the 4th of July approaches, and share your commentary on it, too. We're at KCURCST. Kelly Easley, Sean Hammontree, thank you both.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can catch anything you might have missed on today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where we archive all our conversations, kcur.org/Central Standard. It'll be there later today. Tomorrow, our portrait session turns the lens on Tim Finn. This show is produced by Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Sylvia Maria Gross, with help from intern Trevor Hook. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.